Bible worm, Bible worm, reading the Bible, Bible worm. Hello and welcome to Bible Worm, chewing our way through the scriptures. I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Hendricks College and pastor of Mercy Community Church in Little Rock. I'm joined this and every week by my friend and colleague Dr. Amy Robertson, biblical scholar and executive director of Congregation Beit HaVerim, a synagogue in Atlanta. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text, both as scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian. This week, we're following Paul to Corinth, reading Acts 18, 1-4, and 1 Corinthians 1, 10-18. We talk about factionalism in our communities and the importance not of uniformity, but of commitment to the core principles that hold us together. We think about the human tendency to attach ourselves to our leaders and Paul's insistence that the Christian community should attach itself only to Christ. And we wrestle with Paul's contrast between eloquent wisdom and the foolishness of the cross, which alone conveys the power of God. Thanks for joining us. Hey, Amy, how are you this week?
I am doing all right. How are you?
I'm doing really well. My dear spouse just made orange sticky buns for breakfast, but I'm doing a podcast, and I can't figure out how to eat it. So there's the delicious orange sticky bun sitting right here next to me.
You brought it into the room with you?
I did.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, because it was warm and delicious looking.
Are long pauses in your response to what I say, we can all assume that what's happening is Bobby's eating a sticky bun. Look, he's doing it right now.
So this Bobby. Week, we're in chapter 18.
Welcome to the pandemic edition. We don't know what day it is. We've stopped wearing pants, and Bobby's going to chew for the whole podcast.
Bible worm, chewing our way through the scriptures.
That's good. Chewing our way through the sticky, sticky scriptures.
So this week we have moved from Thessaloniki to Corinth. So we're starting out in Acts chapter 18, verses 1 to 4, which I think is really just in the narrative lectionary, mostly to give us some sense of movement toward Corinth. But we have a few things interesting to talk about there. And then We're spending most of our time in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 10 through 18. So Acts chapter 18. Verses 1 to 4. After this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. There he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus. He had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla because Claudius had ordered all Jews to leave Rome. Paul visited with them. Because they practiced the same trade, he stayed and worked with them. They all worked with leather. Every Sabbath he interacted with people in the synagogue, trying to convince both Jews and Greeks. So we have arrived in Corinth. We're still in Greece. Anything about Corinth that we should say?
I mean, what I know about Corinth is that there was a Roman center of trade there. We know from Philo, who's a Jewish writer at that time, that there was a sizable Jewish community there. Mm-hmm. And then the text tells us a little bit about Jews being sent out of Rome, but maybe we'll get to that in a minute. Is there anything else you want to sort of fill in about Corinth in general?
Yeah, just a couple of things. Like, those things are really great. Corinth is it's in the Peloponnesus, which is the southern part of Greece, and it's right on that little isthmus that connects the Peloponnesus mm-hmm. with Macedonia. And so it's a very strategic location, both militarily and for trade, and so lots of trade came through that Gulf of Corinth and then up into northern Greece from there. And so it was in a very strategic place. There's lots of trade, lots of money, lots of people from all around the world were settling there over time. So it's a fairly diverse place. So it's kind of an interesting city. You often hear it, and I mean, if you read all of 1 Corinthians, you'll see more about it. But sometimes Corinth is compared to Las Vegas, sort of a place where, you know, things happen. And you're like, what stays in Corinth?
What happens in Corinth stays in Corinth.
Yeah, because nice. the letter to the Corinthians deals with a whole bunch of crazy stuff about, you know, who people are having sex with and like all kinds of things like that. But I digress.
Oh, man, Paul is in Vegas. This is amazing.
So there's some challenges to founding a church in the Vegas of the ancient world, for sure. Mm-hmm. So then we meet, the text tells us, a Jew named Aquila, and his wife Priscilla, who were ordered with other Jews to leave Rome by the Emperor Claudius. What do you think? What do we need to know about that?
So what I can tell you about that incident is that it is reported, this expulsion of some Jews from Rome is reported also by a Roman historian named Suetonius, who adds a note in there that the reason they were expelled is that they were stirring up trouble, basically, at the instigation of Christus,
right,
which perhaps is Christ, right? So maybe these are, maybe these were Jesus-following Jews who were stirring things up, a little bit like what we saw depicted in the last chapter of Acts, right? Or at least the accusation that was leveled in the last chapter of Acts.
I think that's right. So the expulsion has taken place because the Christian Jews were stirring up trouble. And so all of the Jews were expelled from Rome. This, I think, happened around maybe 49 or 50 CE, somewhere in that period.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Acts talks about Priscilla and Aquila. In other places in Paul's letters, he refers to them in the opposite order. So Prisca and Aquila are the names Paul uses. I mean, one of the things that we pay attention to is the role of women in the biblical text.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Priscilla or Prisca seems to be a fairly significant person in the founding of early Christianity.
I do love the inclusion of, you know, as the text goes on, it tells us that your translation was they both worked in leather.
Right.
The NRSV has they were both tent makers.
Yeah.
I mean, I love that detail. I love the fact that that's point of common ground is what brought them together, not being followers of Jesus,
right,
that they were tent makers. I mean, we actually, the text doesn't tell us at this point what Priscilla and Aquila think of Jesus, right? They're Jews who have been kicked out of Rome, who
That's
are
true.
Tent makers and open their homes to Paul.
Right.
That's how relationships are formed, right? Around these funny things we have in common.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, Paul elsewhere makes a deal about the fact that he was a leather worker, or really mm-hmm. that he was able to support himself based on his trade, mm-hmm. so that when he is preaching to people and trying to found these churches, one of the things he said is, I've never taken any money from you. So I'm like, I'm not in this for my own well-being. So mm-hmm. he's working kind of a job on the side, and then trying to found churches is kind of like his vocation, or his, I don't know, what do you call that? Avocation? I don't know. It's what he does in his spare time.
The rabbis also, the early rabbis placed a great deal of value on working with your hands, learning mm-hmm. a trade, and doing learning and teaching and, you know, bringing the word of God with you and living a religious life. But that the groundedness that comes with having a trade and a concrete contribution in that way.
Yeah.
Is valued in the Jewish community as well.
Yeah, oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, and you're noticing that the Paul seems to be building relationships with, you know, people who are in the trade, in the leather industry. And in Paul's own letters, he never actually talks about going to synagogues and doing the kind of things that Acts depicts him as doing here, going into the synagogue, preaching, and being rejected. So we think that the historical Paul probably actually really did just move to a town, set up a leather shop, make new relationships there, and then sort of the church started out of his leather shop, not out of the synagogues.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, so what you're saying about, like, the people you know and, like, the way you build relationships, like, Paul, I mean, it's kind of a subtle point in the text. It's not really even in this text necessarily, but that's the way he seems to have functioned, yeah.
That's so interesting because, you know, last time we talked about, we tried to put ourselves in the position of the folks who were in those synagogues, right?
Right.
How would our communities now respond if someone kept coming into all our services and trying to persuade us that we were misreading our texts or that we needed to add some sort of very different layer of belief onto our
right.
existing belief system? And so as I read this, for whatever reason, I started to feel all this empathy for Paul, like going week after week into the synagogue
oh,
and
yeah.
trying to argue and convince the people of this incredibly profound, transformative truth that he believed so deeply all the way down to his bones.
Yeah.
And what it must have felt like for Paul that some people believe it and some don't. And it doesn't yeah. seem like he has a whole heck of a lot of control over how people receive that.
Yeah, that's right.
And I was thinking of how much pressure we started to imagine Jesus felt over the course of his ministry, knowing that the end was coming and he had to get his message across. And I wonder what kind of pressure Paul might have felt. You know, that's a hard thing for Paul to go week after week and try to make a case and see that, again, you're not totally driving this train. You can't logically convince someone that what you deeply believe is true is true.
Paul really is an amazing figure in that he doesn't let that stop him from doing the thing that he feels called to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anything else we need to say about the Acts passage?
I want to move on to Corinthians.
Let's move on to Corinthians. Chapter 1, verses 10 through 18. The first 9 verses of 1 Corinthians are kind of the standard introduction in a letter. So Paul has sort of said who it's from, which is himself and Sosthenes. He's given a blessing. He's given briefly thanks to the Corinthians for who they are and how they have, you know, become church together. Fairly quickly, so he does that for 9 verses, and then fairly quickly he moves into an kind of, it's an encouragement.
We have some things to talk about, people.
Yeah, we got some things, yeah. And with Thessalonians, he basically gave thanks for them for almost the whole letter.
Yeah.
In Corinthians.
Yeah, the tone of this one's a little different.
Yeah, there's some stuff happening in Corinth, and we're just going to get a little taste of it right here.
Yeah.
So beginning in verse 10, "Now I encourage you, brothers and sisters, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, agree with each other and don't be divided into rival groups. Instead, be restored with the same mind and the same purpose. My brothers and sisters, Chloe's people gave me some information about you, that you're fighting with each other." So for here we meet Chloe and her people who are giving information to Paul. I mean, I just think it's interesting that suddenly we've got these women, female characters showing up.
Yeah.
That seem really important in Paul's ministry.
Yeah, that there's a group of people who's identified as Chloe's people. My Jewish annotated New Testament suggests that maybe it is a female-headed household, and so her people are whoever is a part of her household. But in any case, it is a group of people who are identified through their connection to a woman, which is notable. Bobby, I think that next time you find any disagreement in your community, you should simply say, "There should be no divisions among you." Stop it.
No, that totally works. Do not be divided. Paul's actually going to make a relatively convincing case about why that should be true in the Christian community.
Yes.
But, yes.
It feels very, it feels very reminiscent of, I was going to say pandemic parenting, but maybe all parenting. It's just like, stop it.
Yeah.
Stop it.
You know, so he's critiquing the community for sure, but he is at least here framing it in a positive way. Like, I encourage you to agree with each other. Which is saying stop it, but it's saying it in a, like, it's trying to spin it. It's like, you know.
I'll try that at dinner tonight.
Yeah, like, I believe you can get along with your brother.
I encourage you to agree with each
other. Yeah. The main kind of critique that Paul has here is this sort of factionalism where there are divisions. And as you read through 1 Corinthians, you see there's divisions between rich and poor. There's divisions between people who think of themselves as belonging to one or another apostle. There are divisions about who's above who on the social hierarchy. There's all kinds of things. The people in the community are suing each other in court. There's all kinds of things that are happening in this community.
Yeah.
And here, Paul doesn't seem to be addressing any particular thing, but just the very fact of falling into factions all the time.
Right. We're supposed to be on the same team here.
Right. What do you make of this be restored with the same mind and the same purpose?
My thought is, you know, just that very basic idea that the purpose is to live a life of faith in Jesus and prepare for the end times, which are imminent, right?
Mm, yeah.
And if that's what Paul means, I keep thinking, you know, once again about how complicated this was in these early years after Jesus was not with them anymore. You know, Jesus is not super specific in, you know, in like how exactly this living a life of faith in Jesus is supposed to look.
Right.
And so the fact that now there are all these questions and arguments about how does sexual behavior relate to faith in Jesus? how does the role of women in the community relate to faith in Jesus? How do, you know, there are all kinds of questions that are sort of where the rubber meets the road,
right,
that are not, at least in Mark, were really, they just didn't come up. There wasn't time for that kind of detailed conversation. So the fact that people are falling into factions or are confused about what is the right thing makes sense to me. And I feel like this imperative that's coming from Paul is at least take a step back and try to ground yourself in that shared faith as you're navigating whatever decisions it is you have to make. And I understand that Paul does get a little more specific in some of this stuff later, doesn't he?
He does, for sure. Yeah, but I appreciate what you're saying. I really appreciate what you're saying, because sometimes the Corinthians, and I mean, I think I might accuse them of this, they just get a reputation of being difficult people. And what you're saying is, like, look at the situation that they're in, and really there is a lack of clarity about what they ought to be doing. And so we could
There's a lack of clarity!
We could choose to read them as people who are all trying to figure out the way to live this new Christian life, and they don't have great direction, and so they're just trying in the best way they can to figure it out. And I like that. I'm not sure. I kind of want to hold both of those possibilities in mind, because I do think at some points in Corinthians that you would see if you read all the way through that they are, some of them have kind of let the privileges of Roman society kind of enter into the church community. So mm-hmm. I'm wealthier than you, and therefore I can do this thing to you. And I think mm-hmm. Paul's trying to correct some of that. But I do appreciate what you're saying about we can also read them as well-meaning people who are all trying to do what they think is right, who just don't really know. And I mean, in some ways, that to me is a nice parallel to a contemporary situation where we're trying to figure out, I mean, in the narrow picture, how do we be communities of faith together in the pandemic? But even in the bigger picture, like, what does it mean to be communities of faith together in the 21st century in a time of rapid transition of mm-hmm. like the world? What does that look like? And we don't know all the time. And so we're all trying, like, we too fall into factions, not because we're necessarily because we're factional people, but just because we're all looking for the way forward.
I like that comparison to the present moment. And I think that your comment earlier applies very well to this situation too, that yes, it is true that there are a lot of different ways that we could live well into our faith in the moment that we're in.
Right.
And people will parse that differently, and it may turn into factions. But there are also a lot of ways that you can sort of lose your grounding in the faith, because we do live in a highly capitalistic society, and we do live surrounded by all kinds of greed and temptations and empire, you know, whatever language you want to put around it. So you're right. It's all in the mix in this text, and it's all in the mix in our world.
Yeah.
Too.
I like that. And you're not always aware of what other people's motives are, but you're not always even aware of what your own motives are.
Yeah.
To what extent are you protecting your own kind of self-interest, and to what extent are you really doing like what you think the faith really, really is?
Right. And when we're trying to sort of ascribe motives to other people, it is all the more complicated.
Yeah. This language about same mind and same purpose, you know, one way of reading that is that Paul thinks there ought to be sort of a forced uniformity, like everyone ought to just like get on the same page. But I like to think that what Paul really means is there is sort of a core belief that everybody in his community should share. And we're going to get around to that more toward the end of the passage, but it's essentially Christ and him crucified. So what I think Paul is after with this one mind, same purpose language is not exactly that people ought to agree about everything all the time, but that people in their disagreements ought to remember the core that holds the community together mm-hmm. and relate to each other out of that core rather than mm-hmm. out of the factions.
Mm-hmm.
And so though you and I might disagree about something, we disagree out of a sense of caring for one another and belonging to one another, having a ultimate common purpose with one another.
Mm-hmm.
So not trying to erase disagreement, but trying to contextualize disagreement within the bounds of community.
Yeah, that's really well said. And very applicable now, too.
Okay, picking up in verse 12. What I mean is this, that each one of you says, I belong to Paul. I belong to Apollos. I belong to Cephas. I belong to Christ. Has Christ been divided? Was Paul crucified for you, or were you baptized in Paul's name? Thank God that I didn't baptize any of you except Crispus and Gaius, so that nobody can say that you were baptized in my name. Oh, I baptized the house of Stephanus too. Otherwise, I don't know if I baptized anyone else.
Okay, that's my favorite addition ever.
Yeah.
Like, actually, I don't remember what I did, but you get my point.
Yeah. I don't really remember.
It's been busy. It's been busy.
Yeah. Probably Paul was speaking to a what do you call a... stenographer. Someone. That's not the word I'm looking for, but... Manuensis, maybe? I don't know.
He was using voice to text.
Exactly. Yeah. Alexa, write a letter to the Corinthians. Yeah. And so, but I like to think of him as actually like writing that down and then being like, oh crap, I can't erase it. I can't, I forgot about these people I baptized and I can't, there's nothing I can do. So he's like, I don't want to make, who's the one? I don't want to make Stephanus and his family upset. Right. So I got to go back and add them in.
Add them in and then just say, actually, I don't know who else I baptized, but
yeah,
maybe my point stands.
Yeah. So what do you think what do you take him to be doing here with this conversation about baptism?
I think this is a fascinating conversation. And again, it relates so quickly and easily to today for me. So I have to slow myself down a little bit in jumping to today.
Yeah.
But the idea that, you know, humans want to attach to humans.
Yes.
And I think that's part of the power of Jesus coming to the earth in human form, right? Humans want to attach to humans. And so what I see here is when people are baptized, they form that attachment to the person who baptized them.
Yes.
To the detriment of their attachment to the faith.
Yes.
You know, I love that he uses himself as the example here. Was Paul crucified for you?
Yeah.
Paul was not. Paul is writing this letter.
Yeah. No, I love snarky Paul. And I mean, sometimes I don't love snarky Paul, but right here, I love snarky Paul. And he's, and saying why are you attached to me when I'm not the person you should be attached to?
Yeah.
I really like that a lot because, you know, you could imagine him saying why are you attached to Apollos or Cephas? Cephas, by the way, is the Aramaic name for Peter.
Oh.
Yeah, so we're talking about the disciple Peter here. Mm-hmm. But he could be saying, why do you attach yourself to them when you should attach yourself to me? But he's very clear in that, I wasn't crucified for you. You weren't baptized in my name. So he's taking himself out of the equation. Instead of trying to take Apollos' people down or Cephas' people down, he is taking his own people and saying, what are you even doing?
Mm-hmm.
So I really like that. And what a powerful rhetorical move. To say, was Paul crucified for you?
Right.
I mean, it's kind of funny. You can imagine people kind of laughing about that a little bit, but also that kind of laughter where you're like, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I really screwed that up, didn't I?
Yeah, and it makes me think about, the idea that people do like to form connections with people, and so people form connections with the person who baptized them or the head of their spiritual community or their therapist or whatever.
Yeah.
And that moment when... the person on the other side of that, the pastor or the therapist or whatever authority figure tells you, no, that is not the relationship we have.
Right.
Can be painful.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so it's helpful for me to see it here in the context of a letter, a personal letter that maybe isn't as warm and fuzzy as the Thessalonians was in the beginning, but there is... clearly a personal investment from Paul, even alongside this corrective that he has to issue, that the relationship that you may have thought you had to me is not, that's not the relationship we have. But we do have a relationship.
That's really, I love that example. Yes. Now we know a little bit about Apollos. If we had continued reading on in Acts chapter 18, when you get down to Acts chapter 18, verse 24, the author of Acts just says, there came to Ephesus a Jew named Apollos, a native of Alexandria. He was an eloquent man, well-versed in the scriptures. And he's preaching the gospel. Mm-hmm. This is kind of a rival evangelist who is, kind of making the same circuit, it seems like, as Paul is making. And so, Paul is talking about this person that he could have a rivalry with. But what he's trying to do is say, this rivalry that you have created, I belong to Paul, I belong to Apollos. He's saying Paul and Apollos are not playing that game. You have created these connections, but look, Apollos and I are on the same team and we respect each other's work and we don't want that kind of division between us.
Right. And right. And the point is that you were baptized.
Right.
And you were baptized in the name of Jesus.
Yes.
And by whatever mechanism that happened, I don't personally care.
You were talking earlier about how people attach to leaders, attach to each other.
Yeah.
And I think that's true, just generally speaking, in our own time. In the context of ancient Rome, I think that's particularly true because Rome was organized in a patron-client kind of way. And so everybody mm-hmm. belonged to somebody. Even the emperor belonged to the gods. And so there's this kind of back and forth in this hierarchical structure where you kind of need to know who your patron is. And so one of the things that's playing out here, I think, is people may have a tendency to think of their patron as being the person who baptized them. That's the person I'm responsible to in the faith. And what Paul is saying is, no, Christ is the patron. Right. Christ is the head.
No, that's so interesting. And of course that makes sense, that the model in which your society is structured, in which you've been raised, is the model in which you're going to seek to structure everything else, because that's just how you see the world.
Right.
So it makes a lot of sense that's the correction that has to be made here. Because you do have a patron, you do have a sponsor, but it's Jesus.
Right. Yeah. And so that sort of theological corrective, and then also the Paul, in his own maybe humble brag kind of way, but the sort of the evacuation of his ego in that sense to say, I don't want to accrue societal power by being a patron of all these people. I want to step out of that arrangement and sort of Paul is not the most egalitarian person one will ever meet, but when you frame him in his own historical context of the sort of straight hierarchy of patronage, he is at least trying.
He was doing okay.
Yeah. To model the community in a different kind of way.
Yeah.
Okay, picking up in verse 17. Christ didn't send me to baptize, but to preach the good news. And Christ didn't send me to preach the good news with clever words so that Christ's cross won't be emptied of its meaning. The message of the cross is foolishness to those who are being destroyed, but it is the power of God for those of us who are being saved.
I was grateful for verse 18 after verse 17.
Yeah, say a little more about that.
When I read verse 17 on its own, I thought, how, in my translation, it says eloquent wisdom instead of clever words. How does eloquent wisdom threaten to empty the cross of its power?
Yeah.
Paul feels that part of his call is not to add the human element of eloquence to his work, even if there is the possibility that that eloquence will help to persuade people to become followers of Christ. Mm-hmm. Because if someone becomes a follower of Christ as a result of Paul's eloquence, somehow the power of it is lost.
Right.
Do you see that in that verse?
No, that's a really interesting reading. Yeah. This is one of the things. So just, in my work at Mercy Church, I am often trying to take things that I have learned and thought about in the context of my theological and doctoral education and communicate them with people who just don't care about that stuff, really, and don't have necessarily many of them the educational background to think through some of the things that I've thought through, and many of whom, like, the things that I think about are just not really relevant. And so, I relate to Paul here on this issue of you need to be able to take the wisdom that you have and communicate it to people in ways that cut to the core and that they can understand.
Yeah, and I think, too, of the context in which Paul is saying this in sort of a Greek and Roman culture that has really elevated a practice of logic and sort of oratory practices and is saying that doesn't serve us here and it actually can take us astray.
Yeah.
I'm ready for 18. I'm chomping at the bit. Let's go.
Let's talk about 18.
18 is going to solve all our problems, Bob.
Okay, good. I'm glad.
Okay. The NRSV says, the message about the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. What I see in that verse is the thought that the message of the cross will resonate with you if the power of God is involved. Like, it's an act of God, not the power of logic or reason that enables someone to receive the message.
So if you are one who is being saved, then the message will resonate with you. And if you are not, then it won't.
I guess so. Although that sounds, when you say it that way, it sounds like predetermination is the thought.
It sounds real Presbyterian.
Yay!
Yeah. Yeah. The spirit moves where it moves.
I don't know. What does all this mean to you? What does this mean to you?
I mean, ironically, being a Presbyterian, that's not the way that I read this. But
tell me.
I think I like it. Well, no. What I read is, so the it in the second half of the verse, it is the power of God, is the message. So the message of the cross is the power of God for those who are being saved. And so it's, in my mind, it's not the power of God enables one to hear the message of the cross, but the message of the cross conveys the power of God. So the message of the cross is, look, the Messiah, the Savior of the world, was executed in the most humiliating way by the empire. So for those who are invested in the power structures of the current empire, this message that power comes through death and resurrection makes no sense, and it sounds stupid and foolish. Uh-huh. And because they're invested in the power structures, they are already being destroyed. But for people who can kind of can understand that the death of the Messiah and the resurrection defeats the power structure, and death, which is the tool of the empire, no longer has any power, and so all bets are off in terms of the hierarchy, for those people who can see that, they're already being saved.
Interesting. So I really like that. And does that feel directly connected to you to verse 17 or not so much?
I mean, I think when Paul uses the phrase eloquent wisdom, or in the CEB, clever words, mm-hmm. that he's thinking about this kind of education or preaching that is ultimately in the service of the empire. And so I think what Paul is warning about is language that sounds really pretty, but has lost the revolutionary character of the cross. And if one is not talking about the revolutionary character of the cross, and you're just filling space with vapidness, mm-hmm. then that sounds
that's
really
to be
good,
avoided. Yeah.
But is not mm-hmm. going to overturn the world, mm-hmm. then it's a problem. And so in that sense, I think they're related. If you're mm-hmm. preaching the cross as a revolution, that's what Paul wants. It's the meaning of the cross, and that is the power of God. What do you think about that?
I like that. The message itself is so revolutionary that if you are deeply tied into the structures of the empire that exist already, first of all, that the message is about the perishing of those structures. So in some ways, I feel like that is, you're perishing just in that way.
Right. I think that's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, I definitely agree with you that there is a message here of the evangelist can't control who receives the message, but you gotta preach the message, right? You gotta say the thing clearly and simply to give people the best shot. And then, I mean, I think there's some kind of connection between what you're saying about the power of the Holy Spirit and where does it move, and also people's enthrallment to the power of the empire and what prevents people from being able to hear the gospel. And I mean, I don't know exactly how those two things work together, mm-hmm. but I think somewhere in that, like, who does God empower to hear the message? Who does the empire mm-hmm. kind of prevent from hearing the message? Mm-hmm. Somewhere in there is this issue of the evangelist can, all the evangelist can do is preach the cross, and it will be what it is. But the evangelist shouldn't get caught up in this kind of sounding fancy for the sake of sounding fancy, because that's not going to cut it with this kind of revolutionary idea.
Right. And at the same time, being able to recognize that people hearing the message are going to form a relationship with the person who they heard the message from.
Yeah.
And how do we account for that? And how do we not let it take a disproportionate amount of space and not become a distraction? But also, you are going to stay with your fellow leather workers because those are your people.
That's your community.
You know, and we have to be able to use those relationships in our ministry in the world And also, yeah, also not let that relationship take the place of the whole purpose of all of this. Yeah. The good news.
I think that's exactly right. So you're starting to think about how this message resonates with contemporary communities. Yeah. Is there more that you would like to say about that?
I think these texts just really pull out for me the question of the role of the pastor, the role of the community leader, and the community leader's relationship to the community, and ensuring that each member of the community also has a relationship personally to faith and to the message of the cross and to Jesus, and that it isn't all funneled through the community leader, but also use the power of that relationship, because humans like humans.
Yeah.
And that's a complicated thing, but it's really interesting to see how Paul is working it out in these early days of the church.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right.
What do you think is a central message that we want to pull out?
Well, I'm thinking along similar lines, and I'm thinking of it also sort of beyond the role of the community leader, although I think that's really important. But just thinking about your point that people like to attach themselves to other people, and I mean, people even like, we like to attach ourselves to like not people. Like we like to form these kind of in-groups in all kinds of ways. So like, you know, I'm an Android guy, but some people are like Apple, you know, like I have iPhone people, mm-hmm. or, you know, PC versus Mac or Coke versus Pepsi or like whatever
Mets
it is.
Yankees. Yeah.
Yeah, no, mm-hmm. for real. And so this is kind of a natural human tendency, is to want to find an in-group. And what Paul is saying here, I think, is there's only one in-group that ought to matter, and that is the in-group of, for his community, the in-group of belonging to Christ. Like, your faith community is the one. And I mean, even that plays out to just within internal to the Christian tradition. Like, we want to be like Presbyterian versus Methodist, or like there's all kinds of ways that we think, you know, I'm Reconstructionist Jewish and I'm Reform mm-hmm. and I'm Orthodox or whatever it is. There are ways that we divide ourselves up that way, which can cause these sort of separations. And so Paul is saying, like, yeah, like, okay, but none of that is ultimately what matters. What ultimately matters in his mind is Christ and him crucified. It's mm-hmm. we belong to the cross. And that sounds foolish. And so it's probably going to bring you some scorn from people, instead of everyone being like, oh man, you got the new iPhone. They're going to think like, what the heck are you doing worshiping a crucified Messiah, right? And so it might not get you what you want, but that's because this kind of patronage system is going away. So the system is perishing. And so you need to be attached to something other than the system.
That's a lot to think about. This is one of those weeks that, I don't know if we're allowed to confess this, but we kind of came into this and said, well, I don't know if I have anything to say about this text. And I love it when we come in that way and then we found a lot of things to say.
A lot of things to say. You're giving away our trade secrets that we don't know what we're doing, Amy.
Sorry. It's magic. It's organic.
I'm fairly sure people know that we don't know what we're doing. But I mean, Paul says you should speak foolishness and not eloquent wisdom. And so I feel like to that extent, Bible Worm is killing it.
Thanks for a great conversation.
Yeah, Bobby. Likewise.
I look forward to the next one.
All right, I'll see you next time, Amy.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Bible Worm. Next week, we'll be discussing 1 Corinthians 13, 1-13, which is famous, but for all the wrong reasons. We'll see you then.